Welcome to Classic Rain Hamcast number 34, posted February 6, 2021. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR. Not many folks can work for a government agency and leave a legacy like Ralph Heller, N4RH, did. The accomplishments resulting from his years working for the Federal Communications Commission included implementing the Vanity call sign system, instrumental in introducing the first volunteer amateur exams to the Dayton Hamvention, instrumental in getting frequency coordination for VHF-UHF amateur radio repeaters, and started the process of reducing and eventually eliminating Morse code as a requirement to become a ham operator. Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, interviewed Ralph for Eric's weekly QSO Today podcast in 2020. This is our second and final excerpt from that conversation.
When you were running the private radio bureau, how important were amateur radio official observers helping you keep at least the amateur radio portion of it clean?
I didn't really ever have any direct interaction, so I can't really give you an answer to that question. I certainly was aware they were out there. I knew they were doing a job to help keep the amateur radio service in check, but I never received reports from the ARRL on how many people they would send notices to and all. I knew they were there, and I knew they were doing good, but I couldn't quantify it in any way.
Can you recall any major enforcements against an amateur radio operator during your tenure there at the FCC that perhaps is quite memorable to you?
I really don't want to go into specific cases, but I would say the majority of issues that became problematic were with amateurs who were intent on causing interference. For one reason or another, they were either just cantankerous or they would get upset with somebody else, and trying to find and resolve interference issues was a problem. Some amateurs also would get involved in setting up unlicensed broadcast stations, so we'd wind up having to find those stations and close them down and then take action against their amateur radio license. That was primarily it, interference issues, and occasionally we would find somebody operating illegally in some way, overpower. That tended not to be a great problem in the amateur service. That was much more a problem in the citizens band service, where they were limited to 5 watts, and our people would go in and find them running 300 or 1,000. So really, most of the enforcement was much more on the citizens band side than the amateur side.
I remember pirate broadcasters in Southern California. I was never one, but I knew some. It seemed to me that there was this compulsion to play records on the air. They couldn't help it. Did the FCC ever make some kind of spectrum available for this?
Yes and no. Under Part 15 of the FCC rules, which is the part that regulates all of the unlicensed activity, there are provisions for low-power broadcast stations, both in the AM band and the FM band. There are limits on power and limits on antenna length. If someone complies with those requirements, they can put a station on the air, but it doesn't have a particularly long range. So, yes, there is a provision whereby you can do it, but you can't serve a whole town with it.
Are you still with the FCC now, or are you retired?
I left the FCC in 1996, and I became a consultant primarily in the land mobile services, police, fire, emergency, medical, and the business radio services and taxi cabs, helping people design radio systems and get licensed by the FCC. Did that till 2012, at which time I took a position in frequency coordination. The FCC certifies frequency coordinators in the various public safety and business radio services. I started working for the Forestry Conservation Communications Association, which is one of the certified public safety coordinators, and I continue to do that now, although I'm just part-time now. I'm a general manager of that operation, but I've gone to part-time. I'm basically about 90% retired today, but I have not been at the FCC for 20-some years.
Ralph, in 2009, you received the Barry Goldwater Amateur Radio Award for unique contributions in the field of amateur radio. What are those unique contributions that you made?
Well, I was very honored to receive that award. I had the great opportunity to meet Barry Goldwater since he was from Arizona, and that was part of our district when I was in the field office. But I was very honored to receive the award. Perhaps a number of things that went into it. It's more like a lifetime achievement award, I guess. But some of the specific things that I, at least I'm proud of, is I implemented the Vanity call sign system while I was chief of the Private Radio Bureau. I also was instrumental in the first volunteer amateur exams at Dayton, Ohio. We worked with the local radio club, and we actually went out there, gave the exams to the volunteers, let them give the exams, and we sort of monitored the whole thing. And from that, proceeded into the volunteer exam program that we have in place today. I was also instrumental in getting frequency coordination for amateur repeaters as part of the VHF-UHF operations for amateur radio, which at one point there were a lot of repeater wars, people saying this is my frequency and somebody else saying it's my frequency, and getting frequency coordination into amateur radio I think was a big step forward. And I also felt that the Morse code requirement had kind of become obsolete, and so started the process of reducing and eliminating Morse code requirements to become an amateur. So those are all sort of things that I hope went into the Barry Goldwater Award. They never tell you for sure, but I think those are some of the things that have had a pretty big impact on amateur radio, and I think a positive impact on amateur radio, both in letting people get their own call signs and also encouraging people to come in. I think Morse code was a big detriment for a while to people coming in to be amateurs. So those are some of the things, at least, that I've done over my career that I think are important to amateur radio.
Well, you know, what's interesting about the loss of the Morse code requirement, I actually think it was a good idea, but it appears to be now that there's a higher percentage of amateur radio operators who are now operating Morse code than there was before.
I think it's human nature. When you're required to do something, you resist it. But when you're allowed to do it, if you want to, you're more inclined to do it. And I think that may be just something related to human nature.
I've interviewed a lot of hams who operate Morse code and continue to operate Morse code or have gone to Morse code. Your episode is 328. And I think that part of the idea that they want to do this now is because I think we're so inundated with visual and audible information that just sitting down for an hour and having a conversation on CW, there's some kind of zen about it, some kind of meditation that goes with that, that's kind of a break from the routine where we're just completely bombarded all day long with news and information and noise and everything. What do you think about that?
I think you've hit on something, because when you're operating on Morse code, it requires a full commitment. There are a few people that can operate a key and listen to what's coming over the air and still talk to somebody in the room. I know one of them who I was always amazed could do it. But for most of us, if you're on Morse code, it's a full-time commitment to carry on that conversation and completely blanks your mind of all the other stuff. And I think it can be a very relaxing activity.
There should be another book at some point. I'm sure someone will write it, like Zen and the Art of CW Operation.
I like it.
You're listening to Classic Rain Hamcast number 34, featuring our second and final excerpt from a conversation with former FCC bureaucrat Ralph Haller, N4RH. Ralph was interviewed in 2020 by Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, for Eric's QSO Today weekly podcast. We'll conclude our time with Eric and Ralph in a moment. This is the Classic Rain Hamcast. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Classic Rain from www.therainreport.com.
What's the current rig?
The current one is pretty small, an ICOM mobile, a dual band, 2 meter, 440 unit in the car, and use it when I'm in the car. I don't actually have anything set up at the house. I'm in a deed restricted community that limits what I can actually do here. So I'm sort of more content with just the mobile operation and not particularly active on the air these days, I have to admit.
As a person who's involved in national public safety issues, do you think that public safety is missing its simple VHF, UHF channels?
Well, I think we have to step back and say, what is the function of FirstNet? FirstNet was intended to be a broadband data network deployed nationwide. It was never intended to replace the traditional land mobile VHF and UHF systems. Most of those are still in operation. A number of them are expanding because they are the last resort. Most of them are hardened. Not all of the FirstNet facilities are hardened, but most of the critical land mobile systems that are used by public safety are in sites that have backup generators. They're in bunkers, and they continue to operate under the worst of conditions. That is simply not true of the broadband networks. They may or may not continue to work in all situations. So to suggest that public safety has given up its VHF and UHF, I think, would be wrong. It continues to use those and 800 megahertz. Most localities would not be relying on the FirstNet network for their day-to-day voice dispatch kinds of communications at this point. Maybe they will someday, but not today.
Do you think that the sophisticated systems that public safety is now using across America and across the world, that they become so siloed that if there's a fire burning between two cities, they can't coordinate it because they're talking on different channels?
I like to think we're just the opposite of that. When 9/11 happened, there was a big concern that one department couldn't talk to another. Interoperability was a big problem. But frankly, it wasn't a technical problem. It was more a problem of a human problem in that each entity really didn't want others to be able to listen to its conversations. And so we had a silo system that was very intense. 9/11 changed that to where more and more people, one, got on trunked systems in the 800 megahertz band that allowed everyone to communicate. And beyond that, even VHF and UHF systems started putting in gateways so that one system could talk to another. And then FirstNet came along, which makes it possible for anybody that's on FirstNet anywhere in the country to communicate. I like to believe, and I really think it's true, that we have gone much more to a situation where every responder can talk to everyone else they need to.
Did 9/11 change the approach by public safety organizations away from channel exclusivity and privacy?
What it did is it made everybody understand that communication between agencies is critical. I mean, one of the things that we found was people even had radios that could talk to each other, but they didn't know it because the channels didn't have the same names. And so one of the big things that I think NITSTIC has contributed to interoperability is giving common channel names to all of the public safety channels so that if one entity wants to talk to another, if they have the same channel name in their radio, they can both get on that channel and talk. To not be able to talk because you don't know you have the same channel is just inexcusable. That's just one of the things that we've done that I think has really helped interoperability in this country.
Are amateur radio operators useful in emergency events?
Absolutely. I encourage amateurs to work with their local emergency management offices to be part of the operation because amateurs can also communicate when other systems are down. They can provide essential backup communications. It's not police dispatch, but it's providing information in an emergency back to an emergency operations center that's needed and necessary. I really encourage amateurs to work with their emergency management agencies as much as possible to be part of that team. It's a little harder, I think, to get that expertise out to the general public, but if you're in an area and you've worked with community leaders to say, hey, we're a resource, we're here if you need us, that's another way that amateurs can get involved.
When you speak to amateur radio groups, what perspective would you bring to the amateur radio community that should be heard?
I try to have a theme that amateur radio can be lots of things to lots of people. And if you want to get involved in amateur radio, you should take advantage of all of that. And whether it is improving your technical skills, improving your communication skills, improving your public service skills, any of those things, amateur radio provides an outlet that you can do that. It's an outlet that allows people to learn. It allows people to grow. And it allows interaction with others that have similar interests. So my basic theme is that amateur radio has not outlived its usefulness. It's different than it was 50 years ago or 20 years ago. It involves other technologies like the internet today, but it's still an opportunity for people with a desire of technical knowledge to be able to get together with others to learn and to mentor. I guess that's primarily what I talk about, other than talking about my experiences at the FCC. The theme that I want people to understand is amateur radio is still viable. It's still a very wonderful way to expand one's horizon.
And that concludes Eric Guth, 4Z1UG's 2020 interview with Ralph Heller, N4RH, who really did leave his mark on the U.S. amateur radio service during his 20-plus years with the FCC. Audio courtesy of QSO Today. Before we go, we have some information about the upcoming QSO Today Virtual Ham Expo. The QSO Today Virtual Ham Radio Expo, scheduled for March 13th through the 14th, 2021, is proud to announce that it is partnering with AirMeet, a groundbreaking conference technology company, to dramatically improve the virtual interaction and networking experience for all attendees. By integrating AirMeet's technology into the expo, attendees will take advantage of live roundtable video chat to interact with each other, with exhibitors and speakers. This includes the outside of each virtual speaker auditorium will now feature a virtual lounge with tables and chairs to facilitate live video hallway meetups, similar to what is found at an in-person event. Attendees can now pull up a chair and meet face-to-face using live video chat for a real eyeball QSO with friends and new friends. Exhibitor booths will now incorporate virtual tables where small groups of booth visitors can virtually sit with exhibit staff to share product demos, answer questions, schmooze, and take orders, all done with live video chat technology. Early bird registration for the expo can be found at https://www.qsotodayhamexpo.com. The Classic Rain Hamcast updates twice a month and is produced by its founder, Hap Holly, KC9RP. This hamcast is copyright 1985-2021 Rain. All rights reserved. Classic Rain number 35 will post February 20th, 2021 on therainreport.com. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, bidding you very 73 from the Radio Amateur Information Network. Keep washing your hands, watch your social distancing, and wearing your mask. And don't forget to keep on hamming!